Jack DeMare Stadium for tonight's game.
It's the Wishbone Podcast, your source for Auburn football discussion and commentary. Now, here are your hosts, Van Allen Plexico and John Ringer.
Hello, and welcome to the Wishbone Podcast, brought to you in association with the War Eagle Reader. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host.
I'm John Ringer.
And John, we have a special episode this week, and probably next. We'll break it over two episodes. But before we get started looking back on Auburn history, do you have any thoughts on the latest developments in the coaching staff hiring process that's been going on?
Sure. It's currently December 23rd. So at this, there may be other hires later this week. Malzahn has set a date of January 4th when he wants to have the hirings completed. That would allow the staff to be out there in time when recruiting opens back up after the dead period after the holidays. Auburn has hired an offensive line coach, which is a little bit strange. His name is J.B. Grimes, and he's a veteran offensive line coach who's kicked around. But it's just weird that we have a coach with the same position with the same last name, Grimes, and I'm sure that we're all going to butcher that over the next year at some point and confuse him with Jeff Grimes, who's leaving.
And it's not the first time that J.B. Grimes has followed Jeff Grimes at the same job, too, which is even more bizarre.
It is bizarre, but it's a, you know, offensive line coaches, I guess it's a small world. Grimes was with Malzahn at Arkansas State, so they certainly have a comfort level with him and in the offense. And he's coached, you know, around the SEC, Missouri and Arkansas, Texas A&M, some of those kind of places. So I think he'll be fine. We've also, the big hiring over the last week was getting Roddy Garner to come back to Auburn and away from Georgia. It's a huge hire for Auburn. We really needed a top-notch recruiter to be able to anchor that side of the staff. He's going to be recruiting coordinator, defensive line coach, and assistant head coach. And those were the titles he had at Georgia. So it's really a parallel move for him. But he got to come home to Auburn. He and his wife are both Auburn graduates. And so that's very exciting. I think it's a huge hire for Auburn. We really needed someone who could be the guy in recruiting and go out and get us some top recruits. And Garner has that reputation as one of the top 10 recruiters in the entire country. The other part of that is huge, is that we took him away from Georgia. Mm-hmm. So at the same time, we're strengthening Auburn, we're weakening Georgia. And I know the Georgia fans are playing it off like it wasn't a big deal, we didn't lose anything. Right. But he is a big hire for us. It's a really big deal. Now, I know a lot of Auburn fans are disappointed because there's been a lot of rumors that potentially Tracy Rocker was coming back. And I think Rocker certainly is probably a better position coach in terms of getting players to play defensive line the way you want them to. But Garner's had a lot of success with defensive linemen, and a lot of guys, they're pros, and his defensive lines at Georgia have been solid. I also think, you know, the way the coaches have worked out so far for Auburn on the defensive side, you know, Harbison could coach a secondary. Ellis Johnson is a defensive coordinator, but he has also traditionally coached the linebackers. And now we have Garner coaching the defensive line. So we could really hire anybody on the defensive side of the ball at any position. So it's possible they could still bring in Rocker and, like, he could coach the tackles and Garner could coach the ends or something like that. Mm. So I think that's within the realm of possibility.
You know, there's a couple of interesting things real quick about Garner. One was I couldn't believe he was, quote-unquote, only making $300,000 a year. And, you know, it's kind of weird to talk about a profession where everybody is knows exactly how much money you make. That's kind of strange, but yeah.
Sure.
And the other was I was very encouraged that he had reportedly told his Georgia players that he hated leaving them and that the only way he ever would have left them was for Auburn. You know, mama called, basically. So that was very encouraging to me. That he sure. That he cares that much about Auburn that he would, you know, that's the only place he would have ever left to come to. So.
Well, and as he said in this press conference, it's a good transition for us to our topic today, because he said at his press conference, you know, that on the mantle of his house, you know, was a picture of MLK and Pat Dye.
Yeah. Yeah, and Jesus maybe, but Pat Dye was right. In the middle.
That's right. So, I mean, it's a good transition for our topic today to talk about Pat Dye and his place in Auburn history.
Right. Yeah. And for those that haven't figured out by now, yeah, today our topic, this episode and probably next, will be the Pat Dye era. And we're just going to dig through some of our memories. This month is the 20th anniversary of Pat Dye's retirement / resignation / firing / whatever you want to call it. And so we thought it might be good to look back over the Auburn career of this critically important head coach in our program's history and talk about the great memories and some of the not-so-great ones. So first, how would you describe your overall feelings about Pat Dye and his contributions to Auburn football?
I love Pat Dye's contributions to Auburn, and I love what Pat Dye did for Auburn football. I think he came in at a time when we were down, when we were really struggling, when Alabama especially was dominating us, and he made Auburn great again. He built Auburn up. We were tough. We played football the right way. He recruited a lot of great, iconic players in Auburn history and coached them well. And, he had success over a sustained period, particularly at the time that we were in school, won 3 SEC titles in a row and had the 89 Auburn game when we got that game on campus. So for those things, I could never say thank you enough for all the things he did for Auburn. I mean, there's things at the end, the way he left, that leaves a little bit of a bad taste in your mouth. But to me, that can't overshadow all the positive things that he's done for Auburn over the years.
No, yeah. The way I look at Pat Dye, I think about toughness, like you said. But and I also think about how he was an Auburn coach that other teams' fans, they didn't like him. But that's a good thing, usually. You don't want other teams to like your coach.
Sure.
But they respected him. You can't say that about a whole lot of coaches that any teams have had over the years. But he commanded respect from our opponents. And that goes a long way because that means you're doing something right on a sustained level that – they have no choice but to acknowledge, your opponents do. He made Auburn, he created a brand, I think, out of Auburn football that we would play very strong defense, that our defensive line in particular and our linebackers would be very strong. He famously said something like he remembered when those blue jerseys put the fear of God in you and he wanted to bring that back. And I always thought that was a good impact. Good image. So, okay. Well, let's start out with his coming in at the end of 1980, and we were at the end of we were kind of in a strange period because Shug Jordan had been there for 25 years, and then had left after 75, and one of his top assistants, I believe, Doug Barfield, had taken over. And Barfield was not the coach that Jordan or Dye, I don't think, would become. He guided Auburn to several kind of mediocre seasons. I think the best one was maybe 8-3 with James Brooks, Joe Cribbs, and William Andrews. We had a pretty good running game during those years and scored a lot of points, but didn't have much defense at all. And so at the end of 1980, Barfield is dismissed, and President Funderburk and the committee, the trustees and all look around, and who was the coach they really wanted, John? Over across to the east.
Vince Dooley.
Yes, they wanted Vince Dooley. What was Vince Dooley in the process of doing that year?
Well, in 1980, Georgia won the national championship.
Yeah, and so he was getting ready to play in the national championship game when Auburn was talking to him I guess that Herschel was a freshman, right?
Yes.
And so there was just no way that our old former quarterback was going to pack up and come home while his team was finally getting to play for the national championship, and he had one of the greatest players in SEC history as a freshman. So it was just terrible timing on our part. And so with Dye sort of turning us down, we cast the net a little wider,
Dooley.
I'm sorry. Yes, with Dooley. With, thank goodness, I didn't turn that. Yeah, with Dooley. So with Dooley turning us down, we cast the net a little bit wider, and one of the names was Patrick Fane Dye, who was currently coaching at Wyoming, but had coached for several years at East Carolina. And before that, that was his first head coaching job, I believe. Before that, he was an assistant, notably for Bear Bryant at Alabama during some of their better years. And so there was a little resistance, I understand, to hire him based on his connection to Alabama. That kind of sounds like the Kirby Smart thing the first time around. But Dye actually decided to just sort of go all in, you'll pardon the expression. He quit his job at Wyoming and told the Auburn president Funderburk, I'm quitting my job. I'm the best man for Auburn, and I want to be available for you, basically. And Funderburk said, well, there's no guarantee you'll get the job, but you're one of the finalists. And Dye's like, well, I can get another job. I can get another assistant coaching job or something. I'm not worried about that. I think I'm the right guy for Auburn. And so they brought him in for an interview just to kind of talk to him. And I think he really impressed those who were in the position to decide with his toughness, his resoluteness. And they famously asked him the question, how long will it take you to beat Alabama? And do you remember what his answer was?
60 minutes.
60 minutes, yes. A great answer. That's one of the greatest interview answers ever. You know?
It is. If you talk about somebody who answers an interview question that long ago and people still talk about it, you know it was the right answer. Yeah. It was the perfect answer.
Yes. And so he was hired, and he showed up and he addressed the Auburn players and told them, you don't know me and I don't know you, but we both know Auburn. And if we start out here just trying to do, what we came to do for Auburn, we'll be okay. And of course, pretty quickly he got to know them and everything. And that 81 team is famous for some close calls. They ended up 5-6. They had some narrow, close calls. But they're even more famous, the 81 first team of Dye, for the spring practice that they had. That was kind of one of those Junction Boy practices where Dye ran some people off that couldn't cut it, including Sam DeJarnette, who transferred to Southern Miss. He said that he always used to say that when those practices were over, there was what he called it, wolf sign, where he meant blood everywhere, fur everywhere, and the ground's all torn up. So the people, I think that Edmund Nelson, the famous, the first of his great defensive line products, said, he said, I wanted a T-shirt that said, I survived Pat Dye's first spring practice at Auburn. He said, that was a bigger accomplishment than anything we did on the football field. He said, we were more afraid of him than we were of anybody we were going to play. And that was sort of Dye's approach, right, to make you not afraid of anybody. And so
they really needed that, especially on the defensive side of the ball. They needed that element of toughness and, being pushed their physical limit to prepare for the SEC and to get better.
Right. And that is certainly what he brought. Okay. So the 81 season,
they lost close games, but they weren't blown out. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I mean, they lost at Tennessee, but it was 10-7. They lost to Georgia and Alabama, but they were both about 11 points. So, they were hanging with these teams, the top-ranked teams in the SEC, highly-ranked teams. I mean, Mississippi State was number 9 in the country, and they lost by 4 points to them. So they weren't quite getting over the hump and winning those games, but they were playing those teams tough. They were hanging with them. They weren't getting blown out in those games.
They even played Nebraska tough in Lincoln that
year.
Sure. So they end up that year 5-6. They end up about 6th in the SEC, but they beat LSU 19-7, and they beat Florida 14-12. So a big win over LSU and a big win over Florida and a big win over Georgia Tech 31-7 at Grant Field. You can see where Auburn fans looked at that year and saw a whole lot of promise and felt like we were really moving in the right direction. Now, they led Alabama And interestingly, remember that we still had not beat Alabama since the 17-16 punt Bama punt game in 1972. And they and they actually led Alabama 17-16 in the second half, I believe, of that game before ultimately falling 28-17 in what was notably Bear Bryant's record-breaking 315 game.
Yep.
So that was some of the highlights of 81. They go on into the 82 season really feeling like things are on the right track, things are moving forward, and 82 really will represent that season that gives you hope. I mean, it to me, 82 was kind of like 2009. You don't win everything, but you can see that things are turning around and moving in the right direction, and it's something to get excited about. There was excitement all around the 82 season and certainly after it. Now, one of the reasons there was a lot of excitement with the 82 season was that we brought in a certain recruit from McAdory High School in Birmingham who would prove to be pretty fair running back, wouldn't you say?
Not bad, as the recent ESPN special showed.
Mm-hmm. You don't know Bo. We did know Bo. There wasn't a whole lot in there I didn't already know, I'm happy to say. But they brought in Bo, and one of the problems Dye had had in 81 was that he wanted to run the wishbone. You know, the wishbone formation is, well, it's not really used much anymore. Maybe the some of the service academies and I guess sort of Georgia Tech, because they're throwback with their coach Johnson. But the wishbone, for those that don't know, is designed. It was created by Emory Ballard and Daryl Royal and that crowd back, you know, in the 50s or 60s. But it was designed for teams that had lesser talent or weren't as big, and the goal of the wishbone is to deliver more blockers to the point of attack than the defense can put there. Now, the wishbone isn't used as much anymore for sort of two or three reasons. One is that defenders have become so fast that it's no longer as effective because the defense can get more, you know, more players to the point of attack in a hurry. But when the defending team was relatively slow back in the day, it was more effective. The other problem with it is that a lot of the time you have the quarterback kind of diving into the hole, almost like a quarterback sneak every third play, and it just tends to get the quarterback killed. And the best quarterbacks don't want to run the wishbone. Generally, they'd rather throw the ball or, you know, toss or whatever than be, you know, sticking their nose where the fullback normally would go. So he wanted to.
I have a couple of thoughts about that.
Yeah.
First is, I think that one of the things is the biggest difference is that passing games are so much better in the last 10 or 15 years.
That's true.
That's another reason the wishbone is fading away, is because at the time it was much harder to throw the ball. Kids weren't doing these, you know, high school 7-on-7 throw the ball 50 times a game kind of things. There wasn't this run and shoot spread kind of offenses around. This was an effective way to move the football. The other thing is, I think we see over the course of Dye's career that he adjusted to the times and adjusted his philosophy to what would work. Mm-hmm. So he comes in, he runs the wishbone because he knows that Auburn can do that and have success at it. It's a way to be physical, to use all the talent at running back we have, and it's a lot of great edge blockers at tight ends and stuff. But then later in his career, you see the adjustment to a more pro-style, wide-open kind of offense.
Yeah, and it's worth noting Alabama was still running the wishbone at this point.
Sure.
They would change out of it pretty quickly, as would we. But it was the big secret weapon that Bear Bryant unveiled, you know, a few years earlier to beat USC out in Los Angeles, if I remember correctly. And it totally took everybody by surprise, and he kept kind of sticking with it. So bringing in the wishbone in 81, he didn't really have the running backs. He had Lionel James. He didn't have his other, you know, Brooks was the last one to go, and Brooks was gone. And so he had Lionel James and like a converted tight end. He had the five six Lionel James and like a 6'4" tight end playing his two halfbacks in the wishbone. So it was very welcome to get Bo Jackson back there. So you in the 82 season you have Lionel James and Bo Jackson as the two halfbacks in the wishbone. Man, isn't that a nice backfield? That's a very diverse backfield. You can get a lot done. That's like a that's like having Ontario McCaleb and like a Ronnie Brown or something. It's almost like what we had in 09 with McCaleb and Ben Tate in a way, except that obviously Bo was much better than any of those. Okay, so we come out, we beat Wake Forest, we win a narrow victory over Southern Miss, where Bo kind of first really explodes on the scene. We go, we have Tennessee at home, and we beat them. We had a lot of home games in a row. Nebraska comes in and beats our brains in, but I seem to recall, and tell me if this clicks with your memory, that Nebraska came in, and even though they beat our brains out 41-7, I think that 7 was Bo, like, doing a standing flip over the over two Nebraska defenders into the end zone.
I believe so, but I'm not...
Like Spider-Man or something? Just like he's standing in front of them, he's up in the air upside down, his helmet passing over their helmets, and he's on his feet in the end zone, and they're just like, where did he go? So pretty early on, you could tell, you know, that was something special. We beat Kentucky with the famous 6 field goals to 1 game. Still at home, shut out Georgia Tech, and beat Mississippi State. There was a loss to Florida that still rankles people, where some of the calls had gone the wrong way the year before. Florida was mad. Call kind of goes against us this year. Florida kicks a field goal and beats us. And then we have, on November 13th, one of the more memorable games of 82, and one that kind of did for us. We didn't mention this a second ago, but the 81 Tennessee game, where we narrowly lost to Tennessee in Knoxville, that's the famous game where the players were just so upset when it was over because they could have won it, and they came so close and they came up short, and Dye kind of consoled them and said, you know, this is the kind of thing that's going to make you men and make you tougher, and, you know, we'll just keep on, right? Well, the same thing happens against Georgia in 82, but Georgia was the number one team in the country. And this was Herschel's last year, one of his last games for Georgia. And it's the famous game where Herschel and Bo, the only time they ever went up against each other in college. And Auburn got the ball down 19-14 and drove all the way down to like the 30-yard line and was throwing into the end zone to beat number one Georgia when time ran out. Mm. And so that's another one of those games where afterward, you know, Dye is telling them they're kind of crying and hurting and feeling bad, and he's, you know, he just, we got to keep on keeping on and do it again and again and that kind of thing. And so he was really good in the locker room at kind of stirring the spirits and reviving the spirits of our players always, I think.
But he also saw that, you know, this was progress for where we were coming and where we were going. It's one of those things you have to kind of lose close and then win close, and then you can win big. You can't. If you're getting blown out, you're not losing close, you're not being competitive. And that's where they were in those games. They were toe-to-toe with the number one team in the country and had a real shot to beat them. And, but that clearly was building a foundation for the next couple of years.
And for the next couple of weeks, too, because next came one of the most famous games in Auburn history. It's always in like the top five, at least. And that would be the famous 23-22 Iron Bowl in Bear Bryant's last game. Last Auburn-Alabama game, where it went back and forth through the whole game and comes down to the end, and Auburn drives down, you know, close. Bo takes a little screen pass and gets down to the one, and then came the famous Bo over the top, and Auburn won 23-22. And the Auburn fans tore down the goalposts of Legion Field. And it was the end of a nine. I still remember the Birmingham News sports headline. It said, Auburn ends a 9-year wait. And there was a picture of Bear hugging Pat. And because, you know, they had been. I got to tell this story. In fact, there was a funny. In 81, when Dye came out on the field beforehand, he said in his book, he said that, you know, Bear liked to intimidate the other team and the other coaches by coming out and walking around the middle of the field and standing there, leaning up against the goalpost, doing all the things he did to kind of say, look at me, I'm Bear Bryant, you better be scared. And so Dye said that when Bear kind of walked out to midfield, Dye met him out there and said something like, you ain't intimidating me, I'm about to get after your ass. and somebody said, what did Bear say? And he said, Bear just looked at me and laughed. But he did, you know. And so I think Bear was proud of him. I think Bear considered him one of his boys and was proud to see Dye doing so well, even at his own, you know, expense to a certain degree. So, well, our reward that season was to go to the Tangerine Bowl when it was still called the Tangerine Bowl. It's called the it became the Citrus Bowl and then the Outback, I mean the Capital One Bowl, to play Boston College. And who was Boston College's quarterback, John?
Doug Flutie.
Doug Flutie. Another tough game. And there you have the next two, well, two of the 84 and the 85 Heisman winners going against each other. And Auburn pulls out a 33-26 win. And so you end the season 9-3, and things have certainly improved because that was as good as, you know, at least as good as anything that we had done since, you know, the last few good glory days of Shug Jordan. So any last thoughts about 82 in general, or that Alabama game, or Boston College before we step ahead?
It was a big turning point season where we went from kind of playing tough and potential to beating Alabama, winning some big games, getting a bowl game, winning a bowl game, winning nine games. We were clearly, and we had a lot of talent coming back. It was clearly set up where the foundation had been laid to, you know, compete for the SEC title.
Yeah. And indeed, the very next year we did, and we won the SEC for the first time in a while. We got to play in the Sugar Bowl for the first time in a while. We won 11 games for the first time ever. And we were awarded the New York Times National Championship because it was computer-based and based on the actual strength of schedule, because we played the hardest schedule in the country in 1983. And if you don't know already, wait till I tell you a few of the teams that we played and who they had. But the 83 season, we start out with a nice win over Southern Miss. But then came really the one of those moments, and there's probably about five, you know, moments you look back on in Auburn history and say, if only. Mm-hmm. We're going to get to a couple more of them before we're done here. But the September 17, 1983 game against, at the time, number 3 ranked Texas would go down as one of those really missed opportunities. If we had been playing the Citadel, if we had been playing Ball State, you know, if we had been playing Louisiana Tech, anybody except Texas or Nebraska there, we would have gone to the Sugar Bowl undefeated. Although, interestingly, it might have been like 2004 where we would have been undefeated and still not gotten the national championship. Well, no, because the way things worked out. Okay, because you had two other big teams undefeated going into bowl season that year, Nebraska and Texas. So, and Auburn was third going in. So, kind of a lot like 2004, except that in 2004 both teams won. In 1983, both teams lost, and we still ended up in third place. I don't understand it. It drives me crazy. I can laugh now. You know, I can laugh.
But it is. For people who don't know, you know, younger people who weren't around at that time, it really was a situation where there wasn't a BCS, there wasn't a playoff. Auburn was ranked third going into the bowl games. Mm-hmm. We won our bowl game. The teams that were ranked first and second lost their bowl game. Mm-hmm. Under the normal logical way you would rank the teams, we would move up to first and end the year as number one, and we'd win the national championship. But because Miami beat Nebraska in the Orange Bowl in that super dramatic win, people jumped Miami from fifth to first over us.
Yeah, and that game was on at the same time as ours, so people were watching it, and nobody was watching us.
Right, and we played an excellent Michigan team and a tough defensive, low scoring struggle that wasn't as entertaining as the Orange Bowl. So most people didn't see it, and that was contributed to people voting for Miami.
Yeah, I remember flipping the channel over to the Orange Bowl, and the NBC announcers were saying, "This is the game for the national championship," and I'm going, "No, it's not." But you know, and the other thing was when you jump Miami from fifth to first over us, they had a loss, and not only that, they had lost to Florida, who we had beaten.
Yep.
So yeah, that. The 83 one, you know, every one of our fabled missed opportunity national championships, and there's several, has a different sort of character to it. And the character of this one was done wrong by the voters. You know, the others were like stuck behind undefeated teams as well, or started too low, or on probation, or whatever. But this one was the treated unfairly by the voters. All right, well, so we lost a game to Texas where they ran back a kick or something for a touchdown, and we had a turnover or something, and you know, it was a 20-7 game, but it was closer than that makes it sound, and it was early on in the year too. We rebound, we go up, beat the stew out of Tennessee. That's the famous game where I believe was it Trey Gaines had the punt return?
I think so.
Slipped through the tacklers and took off down the field, and we beat Tennessee 37-14. We wouldn't do a number like that on Tennessee again until 2004 with Carnell and Ronnie Brown. 21 years later, we win a really tough game over a Florida State team with a lot of offense. I think that was the game where Greg Carr, the future All-American, intercepts Florida State's winning pass in the end zone to seal the win. All those games with Florida State are fun, well, except for one, close except for one. But that one was particularly an entertaining game. It's worth noting, by the way, that almost none of these were on TV. The Texas game was the only one on TV until the Georgia game. So that's another reason, you know, all the voters around the country, the only time they'd seen Auburn on TV that year was losing to Texas.
Yeah.
So everybody remembered that. Nobody remembered us beating Florida because it wasn't on television. So
it's amazing to think a game between two top five SEC teams was not on television. Yeah. Think about that now.
Oh,
ESPN would have the trucks parked out there and the game day set. They'd be promoting that thing 24 hours a day. CBS would be running commercials every 5 seconds for that game.
And it's hard to imagine today that the 83 and 84 Auburn-Florida State games were not on television.
Sure.
By 85, we were on, but I've got that tape around here somewhere. But 83 and 84, and well, they sure regretted not having 84. We'll get to that in a minute. Okay, so we win, we beat down Kentucky, Tech, Mississippi State, win a really hard-nosed, tough game against number 5 ranked Florida in late October, 28-21. Bo had a good game. Florida was really strong and tough, but we were able to pull that one out. This is, again, the Florida team that beat the national champions that year, depending on what poll you look at. And then the next week we play Maryland, who was ranked number 7. Who was their quarterback?
Future NFL player Boomer Esiason.
Yes. So Boomer came into Jordan-Hare, and that was the game. Do you remember this, John? I don't mean to be quizzing you here, but this is kind of fun. Do you remember the player for Auburn that had the big game on offense for us that day against Maryland? It was very unexpected.
I do not.
It was the fullback, Tommy Agee.
Yes.
Maryland geared their whole defense against stopping Bo and, I guess, Lionel. And we just kept slipping that fullback up the middle, and they couldn't stop him. And Agee had like 150 or 200 yards, something ridiculous for a fullback, you know. Agee had a great game that day. I still remember, you remember Birmingham had the Mark and Brian, the two radio shock jocks in the morning that we would listen to growing up in Sylacauga. I did. And and they were always kind of making fun of Bo in a good-natured way, but kind of, you know, teasing him. And so they had him on there, and they said, well, the crowd was cheering AG. And their version of Bo says, yes, for always great Bo Jackson. So we beat Maryland with Tommy Agee's contributions. That's where he kind of emerged as another option at offense. And then we go in and play one of, I think, the toughest, hardest-nosed, greatest games that's sort of underrated in Auburn history. We were number 3, and we played undefeated number 4-ranked Georgia in Athens. Now, we hadn't beaten Georgia in a couple of years. This would be the year after Herschel turns pro, but they still had a really, really good defense and pretty decent offense. What are your memories about that game?
I just remember it was huge because I grew up in Atlanta, and I remember how good Georgia was at that time, you know, in the years right after they won the national title and how much talent they had. And I just remember it being a really, really physical, tough game with both teams really going at each other. And Auburn was able to pull it out. I mean, it's a close, low-scoring game, 13-7, and Auburn did enough to win.
Yeah, that's the game when I really think back to what Pat Dye meant to Auburn. making us tough enough to go into Athens and just smack heads with Georgia for 60 minutes and get a low-scoring, tough win. To me, that is like a signature Pat Dye game right there. And at his, you know, his alma mater and everything. He had to mention that that was part of the interesting stuff that year with, I mean, with Pat Dye was that in those days was that Vince Dooley was an Auburn quarterback coaching at Georgia, and Pat Dye was a Georgia offensive lineman coaching for Auburn. And so, and the series was just so close, you know, so that was a really neat thing, you know, even back then. So, and I also remember the television coverage showing the Georgia cheerleaders crying on the sidelines because they had won the SEC their first 3 years, and this was their only year they didn't win the SEC. And so Auburn sort of swiped it away, and they were so upset, and I hated it for them. Now, the 83 Iron Bowl is kind of an odd one. It was fairly close. That was a 23-20 game. But there were two things that happened in this game. The Legion Field got struck by a tornado almost, and it got struck by Beau. This was the game where the tornado sirens were wailing outside the stadium. Rain was coming down. The wind was blowing. And I think a couple of times Alabama got ahead, and Beau went on a really long run. And then I feel like Alabama got ahead again, and while ABC was on commercial, Beau tore off another run that looked just like the first one. And people thought they were seeing an instant. It's kind of like Punt Bama Punt. People thought they were seeing an instant replay. But we win 23-20. Two back-to-back wins over Alabama. That was huge. This was in Ray Perkins' first year after Bear had retired and then passed away at the end of the 82 season. And so what is our reward for the 83 season? Where do we get to go?
We get to go to the Sugar Bowl and play Michigan.
For the first time in a long time, and we play number 8 Michigan. And what do you said already they were the tough team and it was a low-scoring game. What kind of memories do you have of that game, if any?
Well, first thing I remember is, I mean, it was 9-7. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget the score of that game. And Auburn was losing 7-0 at halftime. It was really Auburn ran the ball really well in that game. We had, you know, several hundred yards rushing, but we didn't allow them to score anymore. We kept rushing the ball and getting in a position and kicking field goals, and that was the difference of the game. And Auburn's kicker that day was, you know, one of the best kickers ever to come out of Auburn and had an excellent NFL career, Al Del Greco.
Mm-hmm.
He was really made a difference that day. We had, you know, over 300 yards rushing on a good Michigan team, and we stopped their offense other than that one drive where they had the touchdown. So it was a tough, low-scoring game. It was two really good teams that were playing hard, and Auburn made enough plays in the second half to get the win win the Sugar Bowl, which is something we hadn't done in a long time.
Yeah, and we thought we'd won the national championship with it. Del Greco hit that last-second kick to win it. And I also remember Bo Schembechler saying before the game that Auburn would not win if they were just going to try to run the ball, and we did. So Bo Schembechler could not fully take into account Bo Jackson, and it worked out. So, all right, so 83, you know, we also need to mention, by the way, the 83 season had begun with the death of our one of our running backs, and that Greg Pratt. And from heat stroke, and that sort of galvanized the team, I think, even more. You know, when something like that happens, you absolutely just hate it, but those things, for whatever reason, just happen occasionally, and it's a tragedy. But it really did sort of, I think, inspire that team even more. So we come out of the 83 season feeling like Auburn has arrived. We were unfairly treated by the voters, ended up third. They even kept Nebraska ahead of us, and Nebraska lost, and we won.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but that was a really amazing Nebraska team. That was the Mike Rozier Heisman Trophy winning, Turner Gill quarterback, you know. Irving Fryer was the receiver. You know, they had a really, really, and a tough line. They always had a tough offensive line defense back then. But anyway, so we go into 84 feeling like we're just going to kind of reload now, right? I mean, we have arrived. We're a national championship contender. And they were doing a game back then called the Kickoff Classic to open the season. It would be a game that would be played in the Meadowlands in New Jersey at the beginning of every season, before the first week of the season, like at the end of August. And Auburn went into that season ranked preseason number one. And we were invited to open the season against the defending national champions, Miami. And, of course, you know, we're licking our chops at the thought of getting to play the team that kind of swiped the trophy from us. Mm-hmm. So we go up to the Meadowlands, and we lose. And that was just a crushing loss. I hated that because I wanted revenge so bad.
Yeah, that was a very bitter loss.
Yeah, because Miami didn't play that great. This was not a great Miami team. Unfortunately, it really turned out to be not such a great Auburn team either. It was, in fact, I think that both teams ended up 9-4 that year. I think that we ended up going 9-3 after that game, and Miami ended up going 8-4 after that game, and so we both ended up 9-4. By the way, this is the year that Miami team is the one that went on to lose to Boston College with Doug Flutie's famous pass.
Sure. That was, I mean, they had, it was a team with Bernie Kosar and those kind of players on it. It was an excellent Miami team.
And it was Jimmy Johnson's first game coaching Miami.
Yeah, taking over for Schembechler.
Taking over for Schembechler, right, who had left for the world, for the, what was it? USFL.
USFL. Your favorite league, oh, USFL.
Yeah, well, I'll leave that alone. And so, by the way, there's a really good 30 for 30 ESPN did called Small Potatoes, Who Killed the USFL. And the whole thing is basically a diatribe against Donald Trump, so it's pretty entertaining. Yeah, so okay, so I'm trying to set the scene here for the way the 84 season began, because that Miami game was kind of a microcosm of how it went. Both Miami and Auburn ended up going 9-4. It's also the answer to one of my favorite trivia questions, which is what year prior to the last few, what year did Auburn play 14 games in one calendar year? And it's 1984, because we played the Sugar Bowl January 1st. And then we played the Kickoff Classic, and then our bowl game that season was a December bowl, so we ended up playing an 11-game season plus three non-season, games. So
that's important. I mean, the Kickoff Classic was – we were still playing 11 games a season back then. We hadn't moved to the 12-game season, and the Kickoff Classic was an extra game beyond the 11 game that those two teams were allowed to play.
Yeah, and then your bowl too. So
sure.
So we lose that one. And start the season 0-1. We dropped from number 1 down to number 11. But it was interesting to see, and in fact, we would begin this season 0-2 and still be in the top 20. I don't know how many times that happens. But we follow that up 2 weeks later, September 15th, we go out to play Texas, who has just turned in an 11-1 season like us the year before and had beaten us the year before. So, and in fact, this may have been Auburn's first game on ESPN, interestingly enough. There's an interesting little tidbit. So we play at Austin against number 4 Texas, and we lose 35-27. But this game is really remembered more for something else that happened in it, which was what happened to Bo. You remember what happened to Bo in this game?
Didn't he get injured?
Yeah, this is where he separated his shoulder. Jerry Gray, defensive back for Texas, grabbed his arm and pulled it, and it was very similar to how he, to that career-ending injury that he suffered in with the Raiders, where the Bengal player pulled his leg out of the socket. Mm-hmm. Jerry Gray pulled his arm out of the socket. I mean, you look at Bo and you realize that he goes he went so fast, and he was so strong that if his body parts were restrained, he would just pull them out of the socket. He was going so powerful and so fast. It's his own power that ultimately did him in. It just is in other words,
that's amazing.
Cadillac Williams' injuries were when people landed on him and broke his bones. Mm-hmm. Bo's injuries were when people held on to him and he injured himself. It's just amazing. So Bo was out with a separated shoulder for 6 games. We then reel off all 6 of those wins, and the game that Bo comes back, we lose. So real quick, let's run through those just real quick. We beat Southern Miss. We beat Tennessee and Auburn. We go beat Ole Miss in Oxford. Then we play one of the most exciting, astonishing, amazing games in Auburn football history on October 13th at Tallahassee. This was the famous 42-41 game.
I mean, again, not on TV.
Not on TV.
They're ranked 9th. We're ranked 16th. We go into Tallahassee and beat them. It's not on television.
This is, you know, I think this is the game that, if he hadn't already, solidified Jim Fife's reputation as a great play-by-play guy, because Fife got to just call the game of his career that night. I mean, you know, there are audio recordings out there that you can get of Fife doing the, you know, the best plays from this game, and they're so entertaining because I forget who his color analyst was that year. It might have still been Pat Sullivan.
I'm not sure.
And the color, I think it was Sullivan. Was very calmly saying players' names, like, and that was Gerald Robinson. Gerald Robinson! Gerald Robinson! So I'll never forget his line when we get the ball back and we're trailing by like 6 with 2 minutes to go. And Fife says, "Here we go, our backs to the wall, our feet to the fire." And we marched down the field, and Coach Dye made the good point that the referee had during one of the play when we made a first down and they moved the chains, and it took them a while to get the chains situated, like 10 or 15 seconds, and the referee did not stop the clock. And Dye is screaming at him, "You got to stop the clock. You got to put time back on the clock." And the referee's like, no, I'm not going to do it. And then ended up that we scored quicker than anybody thought. Florida State got the ball back and was on our, like, 30 when time ran out. And only down 1.
Mm-hmm.
So
if they'd had that extra time, they could have spiked it and kicked the field goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's also the game where I believe it was Collis Campbell had a big game in place of Bo. Wasn't there a play? It's been a while since I've watched my old VHS tape of this game from the Auburn Network put out. It was like their own in-house video. But they put it out. You could buy it for a while there, and I've got it somewhere. But wasn't there a play where, like, we fumbled the kickoff, and then one of our players picked it up and went the whole distance for a touchdown, and the referees were all just standing around not signaling anything, and then they finally go, you know, it's a touchdown, because I remember Fife yelling, "Can he go? Can he go? He can go! It's a touchdown!" That was some great calls by Fife. So, all right, we win the next week against Georgia Tech in a game where we were up like 41-0 in the first half, and they came back and almost caught us, but we won. We beat Mississippi State. And then comes one of the ugly, tough losses of the Dye era. This Florida team was ranked number 13, but my goodness, they were was it still Charlie Pell, or had they gone to Captain Kangaroo yet?
I'm not sure if that. I know he was there next year, but I'm not sure who was there at this point.
Pell got in trouble and got run off, got him on probation or whatever. In fact, because they would have won the SEC for the first time. Florida had never won the SEC until 1990 with Spurrier. But they had those great teams in 83, 84, and 85 that either won it and had it taken away or came up just short. So,
well, and we'll get to 85 in a minute. But in that game in particular, the 85 Auburn-Florida game was as much NFL talent on a field as there's been, you know, until some of the recent games, you know, between the huge teams. There was a ton of players in that game.
Yeah. Well, they had like Neil Anderson and John L. Williams in their backfield, who were.
And that was, I mean, Wilbur Marshall was on defense. They had, I mean, they had a ton of great players.
A ton of players, and they beat our brains in 24-3. Bo came back for that game, but was not 100% and kind of took himself back out of the game. It just wasn't really working too well. So, remember, we're still running the wishbone at this point, so we were purely a run team, and they had a really great defense and shut our run down. So, 24-3. We famously hammered Cincinnati 60-0 the next week. I believe this is the game famous because Atlanta radio and internet guy Chuck Oliver said he finally was going to get in the game. No, it was the next year. I'm sorry. It was 52-7 the next year. I got to mention this while I'm thinking about it. He said that we were up 52-0, and Coach Dye looks at me and says, "Oliver," and then Cincinnati scored to make it 52-7. He's like, "Never mind." Sit back down. They're coming back. So, let's see. We had a tough, good win over Georgia the next week, 15th ranked. We were starting our domination of Georgia that would run through most of the 80s. We really did handle Georgia pretty solid those years. And we go to Alabama for the Iron Bowl. Alabama was having a terrible year. They'd won, like, what, 4 games or something.
That's right.
We were ranked number 11. We were still in the running for the SEC championship. We'd only lost that one game to Florida. I believe if we had beaten Alabama, we'd have gone to the Sugar Bowl, wouldn't we?
I think so.
That's depressing to think about.
This was really, really a tough loss. And one of the few times in the series history when there was a big upset.
Yeah. Well, like I said, look at the stakes that were on the line. I mean, we had beaten Alabama 2 years in a row. We would go to the Sugar Bowl. We win the SEC. We had a superior team, at least on paper, in terms of wins and losses. We had 3 losses. Alabama was at 4-6. But it was not to be. This is the infamous wrong way bow game, where we're down on the goal line the first time with about 2 minutes to go, and we're down 17-15. And we call an option sweep kind of play in the wishbone instead of just sending Bo over the top. And they changed the play at the line of scrimmage, but Bo did not hear the change. And so on 4th down, inexplicably, instead of letting Bo run it, we give it to Brent Fullwood. Now, Fullwood was a good back, but he needs a blocker on the goal line.
Sure.
And I believe it was Sam Shade for Alabama that came up and tackled him for no gain, while Bo was running in the opposite direction of the flow of the play. And Bo was sort of unfairly criticized for this, but if they had just called a dive, it wouldn't have mattered. You know, he'd have scored. Yep. Well, we did get the ball back and drive down again, and we can kick a field goal and win. And Robert McGinty, who we will see again, misses. And basically, Dye pulls McGinty's scholarship before they get off the field. Oh. And so McGinty transfers back home to Florida, and we would see him again. He cost us. That guy cost us on both sides of the line of scrimmage.
He heard us coming and going.
Coming and going. He sure did. Okay, so we end that season 7-4, with the Miami game 8-4, and we go off to play not yet an SEC team, Arkansas, for the first time ever in the Liberty Bowl in a yucky, cold December 27 game. We were down to number 16. Arkansas was unranked. But do you remember what the offense was Arkansas ran?
I'm not. Was it the wishbone too?
They had what they called the flex bone.
Oh yes.
Where they would move one of the two halfbacks kind of out into the formation or into the flat or something like that, and it was a very good. They were a very good option team. I believe they led for a while. They had we fumbled close to our goal line. They punched it in, but ultimately we came back and won. Bo had a good game. Bo got MVP of that game. He got, as Dye said, Bo got MVP of every bowl game he played in, whether we won or lost, which is says a lot about Bo. So we end that year 9-4, and it was kind of a disappointing year, though not really as disappointing as the next year would be. And so we're kind of in the doldrum period with Coach Dye here. So any last thoughts before we go into 85? I think of these years as kind of bookends.
Other than I attended that Liberty Bowl game, and it was a miserable week. It was cold, rainy, sleety, not in Memphis in December, so not – it's not like going to Miami or Orlando or somewhere like that for a bowl game. But it was fun, and we got to see a win. So
we end that season ranked 3rd in the SEC. Florida wins the SEC that year but has to vacate it. LSU goes on and plays in the Sugar Bowl against Nebraska and gets their brains beat in. And Auburn ends up going to the Liberty Bowl. That says a lot, too, that the third-ranked SEC team, when the number one one doesn't even get to go to a bowl, I believe, right, that the second-ranked SEC team went to the Liberty Bowl that year.
Things have changed a little bit since then.
A little bit, yeah. That team, that Auburn team, finished 4-2 in the conference and 8-4 overall, 9-4 with a bowl. I mean, they would have gone to like the Capital One Bowl or the Cotton Bowl or something now, but you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of the Cotton Bowl, 1985. This would be Bo's senior year. He comes back for his senior season. He gains 1,786 yards that year. The second best single season performance behind Herschel's 1891 in 81. And he, of course, will win the Heisman Trophy that year and the closest vote in Heisman history, at least to that point, over Iowa's Chuck Long, who had a really great bowl game to kind of compete with Bo there. Once again, Auburn would be number one in the season. We did not begin the season ranked number one. We started the season ranked number two behind eventual champion, national champion Oklahoma, but Oklahoma dropped a spot when they kind of struggled in their opening game while we beat Southwestern Louisiana 49-7. Now, we made a change on offense going into 85 for Bo's senior year. We would no longer run the wishbone. 84 was the last year Auburn ran the wishbone ever. We converted to the I formation and put Bo back there behind, I guess Tommy Agee was still, yeah, Agee was still the fullback. He was just a junior that year. And Fullwood was the backup, the nuclear sub, I believe we called him, right? And so
I'd forgotten that nickname. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a good one. So we win our first couple, and then one of those really horrendous, embarrassing, you really wish you could forget it losses, where on September 28, ranked number one in the country, and with Sports Illustrated poised to put us on the cover, we go up to Knoxville in what we would later call, in the immortal words of Admiral Akbar,
"It's a trap."
An unranked Tennessee team in Knoxville beat, you know, the number one team in the country in Auburn. That was a tough week.
And beat us pretty soundly, too, 38-20, and I don't think it was even that close. What was his name, Robinson, the Tennessee quarterback, who later does hard time for being a drug trafficker or something? But
he was really good in that game.
In that game, he was like Joe Montana or something. Yeah, he really had a great game. And so they, and it was on ABC, of course, because all of our big early season losses that killed our season in the dire were all on ABC in prime time or whatever afternoon. And so, okay, so 2-1, we reel off four pretty good wins. We shut out Ole Miss, and we were ranked number 12. We got to talk about this game. On October 12th, we were ranked number 12 now. We dropped from first all the way down to 14 and then climbed back up to 12. And we played the number 4 ranked Florida State Seminoles in Jordan-Hare. Now, this was a game that everybody had looked forward to because the last couple had been so good, and especially the previous season with that 42-41 game. And so it started out. Do you have memories of this game, the 85 Florida State game?
Some of those Florida State games in the middle of the 80s are starting to blur together for me. It's a sad say.
Yeah. Well,
I remember we won big. That's what I remember.
Yeah. Well, this is the one that for like the first two or three quarters, it was very close. It was like 7-7, 14-14, 21-21, that kind of thing. And I believe at some point Florida State was up like 27-21 in like the third quarter, somewhere in there. And then we scored. I think Bo had a long run, and we scored. And then we sacked their quarterback. He fumbles, and we score. It was very reminiscent of the way the 2010 Arkansas game went.
Mm-hmm.
Very much like that. A little lower scoring. But we ended up winning 59-27. 59-27 over Florida State. Just think about that for a second.
Number four ranked Florida
Number
State.
Four, 59-27. That's a score you put on Cincinnati back then, or Pacific.
Yep.
59-27 on Florida State. It just everything for them fell apart there at the end, and we crushed them. And it was a and Bo had a huge game, and of course that one would be on TBS. So 15 people saw it. Now, the next week, we're back up to number 8. We're in the top 10, and we go out to Grant Field. And this is another really memorable game we got to talk about quickly. This was Georgia Tech playing very tough. And this is the one where I don't want to get it mixed up with 87. No, this is the one where Bo has the long run.
Yes.
This is the bye-bye, Bo!
87 was the Andre Bruce game. We'll get to that.
We'll get to that. Okay. Let's see. So we have a tough, what they call the game of steel, loss to number two Florida. We were number 6. We lose to number 2 Florida in the game of steel, 14-10. That was a real tough slobber knocker.
Well, and again, I want to point out that there were at least 20 guys in that one game who went on to play in the NFL.
On both rosters combined.
At least. It may have been more like 25 or 30. There were a ton of, you know, NFL prospects, not just the, you know, the upperclassmen, but the younger players too. Mm-hmm. Those two teams were loaded with players, and there were a lot of great future pros on those two teams. It was the NFL scouts were very excited when those two teams played that year.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we go on. We beat. We had a good win over number 12 Georgia. We were 14. They were 12. We go over to our second home in Athens and beat them down pretty good. But then we got to mention another one of those humongous losses that just makes you sick to think about, which was against Alabama again in the Iron Bowl. We were ranked number 7. They were again unranked, and this is the Van Tiffin game.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one where we were trailing in the fourth quarter, and we go on this long drive, and Bo goes over the top, replaying 82, and we score. And I think we go up like 17-16, something like that, or 16-15. And then Gene Jelks tears off like an 80-yard run on the next play, and they're back ahead mm-hmm. again. So we go on another long run, and I believe our big fullback Reggie Ware. Smashed it in, and we go up 23-22. Yeah, 23-22. Well, there was another score that we were very happy with, right? 23-22.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get back out on the field. Mike Shula is their quarterback, and he hits a few passes. And I think he hits one to Greg Richardson, and our little tiny 3-foot-tall defensive back jumps on his back to tackle him in bounds. Because if he tackles him in bounds, they're going to run out of time. And Richardson basically just carries him out of bounds and stops the clock and dies losing his mind. And Van Tiffin comes out and hits a 52-yard field goal to win 25-23 in the most unbelievable, disgusting, humiliating, horrific Iron Bowl. I think it's probably the most painful Iron Bowl loss of all.
It was a brutal loss. We had no business losing to that Alabama team.
No,
none.
No. So 84-85, we lose to Alabama in both in games that we should have won, and that that would have given us an 8-year run over them from 82 through 89, if we had pulled those two out off proper.
Yes.
So that's really disappointing. So all right. So we end the 85 season by getting invited to the Cotton Bowl. We were 8-3 overall, but we were 3-3 in the conference, but 8-3 overall. And we go and play a really good 11th-ranked Texas A&M team who kills us. Jackie Sherrill, I don't even remember who all their players were in that game, but they absolutely shellacked us. But Bo had a really good game and ends up getting MVP again. and he had already won the Heisman Trophy in this game.
I just remember everybody wanted to watch it because it was, you know, Bo Jackson's Heisman Trophy after he won the Heisman, his bowl game.
Mm-hmm.
People were excited.
And then but you know, I think that game was important for the future of Auburn football because it really convinced Pat Dye, if nothing else had, that we needed to make some changes. And certainly I think there are more changes made between the 85 and 86 season than in any other point in his entire run. Would you agree?
It was a big turning point.
he fired some coaches and changed our entire offensive approach, really.
We really got much more sophisticated on offense from that point forward. We're very simplistic kind of passing offense, you know, primarily just handing off right, student body left kind of stuff. And in 86, 87, we got much more advanced.
Yeah. Well, we brought in Pat Sullivan as quarterback's coach, and he was kind of the play caller, or there was a committee to call plays. I mean, you had Larry Blakeney as the receiver's coach, I think, in the press box. You had Pat Sullivan, and you had Dye with his 2 cents worth. For when we needed to dive up the middle, and and so, but we were getting some good, pretty good receivers, and this was the year that Jeff Berger emerges. Now, we haven't really talked about the players as much beside the running backs, but in 84 and 85, we'd had a real quarterback controversy because Randy Campbell had been our quarterback in 82 and 83 and had done so great as an option wishbone quarterback, but he had no arm. And in 84 and 85, we had various quarterbacks on the roster, but nobody ever really emerged. And so Pat Washington, and I don't mean any slight toward Pat Washington. He was a great Auburn man, and he fought, you know, tooth and nail for us in his two starting years. But he just sort of kind of got it by default because nobody ever really stepped up and seized the reins, I didn't think, in those two seasons. And the coaching staff always seemed to turn to Pat Washington almost as like, well, nobody else is going to do it, so it's yours again. And I felt bad for Washington for that.
Sure. I mean, he, you know, he had some really good games, some solid games, and it was a big part of some of these big wins we've talked about. But at the same time, it was never like his job and he ran away with it. And there was never, you know, it was always a who's going to start a quarterback discussion.
Yeah, yeah. So Berger kind of emerges that year as a passing quarterback. You know, he had famously said that when he was being recruited, they'd ask him, do you want to be a running quarterback or a passing quarterback? And he would just say whatever the team he was going to said. So he came to Auburn as a running option quarterback, but he liked to pass and he was a good passer and they coached him up, I think. And so the 86 season, basically, we start the season ranked 14, climb all the way up to number 7, and don't lose until November 1st. You know, we reeled off some pretty big wins. We have a big win over Tennessee and Jordan-Hare. We have a good win the last time we played Georgia Tech on an annual basis in Jordan-Hare. We go into Starkville to play in Scott Field to play Mississippi State when they were 13th ranked and undefeated. But, you know, I always laugh about this game, that Mississippi State coming into a game undefeated in the middle of the season, usually that just means they haven't really played anybody. I hate to say that, but let's be honest. This wasn't the only time we would end Mississippi State's hopes and dreams. And so they come in undefeated. We're undefeated. It's a big clash on ESPN, and Brent Fullwood just tears them up, and we win 35-6. This was also the game that was mentioned on Saturday Night Live that night. I remember they did some skit where like Kevin Nealon or somebody, another guy, are saying, what's on TV? Auburn and Mississippi State. Woo. You know, so, I'm sure, you know, in New York City, they were really excited about that game being on. But, this was also the night of the game 6 of the World Series between the Mets and the Red Sox when Bill Buckner miffed the ball and the Mets went on to win the World Series in Game 7. So that was a kind of historic moment. I think that's right. I remember that. I think I remember that correctly. So the next week, we lose that horrific game in Gainesville to Florida, where we said we'd see Robert McGinney again?
Yes.
We were up 17-0 on Florida, and Kerwin Bell, who was basically in a wheelchair, he was so injured, comes out there and leads him to a touchdown. And then they get like a 55-yard field goal out of McGinty because for Florida, he can hit 55-yard field goals to beat us. But against, you know, Alabama, he can't hit it from the extra point line. And then at the end of the game, they drive down. They score to make it 17-16, Auburn. And Kerwin Bell on the two-point conversion keeps it and staggers somehow with nobody touching him into the end zone, and Florida wins 18-17.
Bitter, bitter taste in my mouth when you say Kerwin Bell and Robert McGinney, I guess.
We were undefeated at this point. We were thinking, this is our national championship, you know, year come again. Here we go. And we go and we lose. You know, and there is something to be said that in Dye's better years, we always felt, after 83 that we were in contention for the national championship. There's always that sense of anticipation. If we just don't lose these couple of key games, we could win the national championship.
Yep.
I have to stress that because, you know, in modern Auburn history, we haven't had that feeling quite as often. And there was really a palpable sense through much of those seasons, 86, 87, 88, 89, there was a sense we could win the national championship with this team and something would always happen, as I always like to say. So,
sure.
So that was it. We lose to Georgia. The next week was the Cincinnati game I mentioned, 52-7. It is funny to think of like Tuberville and Notre Dame's current coach and all, and the Tennessee's coach being, you know, Cincinnati being a program that goes to the Sugar Bowl and all, because this is a team we used to beat. We beat them 2 years in a row. We beat them 112-7.
That's about right.
Yeah, so they've come a long way, I guess. The next week we have Georgia at home. And this is another one of those. I seem to be saying that a lot here, don't I?
This is one of those memorable games that I have Georgia fans that we're related to that still are mad about, you know, how we treated them after this game.
Why don't you tell us, what are your memories of this game, how it played out?
Well, I mean, Auburn was ranked 9th. Georgia was ranked 17th. We should have won the game. Mm-hmm. I think Georgia had a lot of injuries coming into that game, and they started a – seems like the guy that played the huge game was a backup quarterback,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And he had a huge game against us. They won when they shouldn't have won, 20-16 in Auburn. And after the game, the Georgia fans, or some Georgia fans, were running around in the field, and they were all celebrating in the stadium. The Auburn fans had all left, and they kept asking the Georgia fans to leave the field, to leave the stadium, and they didn't. And then they kept celebrating, and finally they turned the sprinklers on the field to wet down the Georgia fans who were there. And then they turned the fire hoses on the Georgia fans who were in the stadium.
This is the famous nothing stinks like a wet dog game.
And it's hard to imagine that now, 2012, how many like videos of that would be on the internet and stuff. God. But they literally turned the hoses on people in the stands and wet them down to get them to leave.
Yeah.
And they left. And I just remember, some Georgia fans I knew had been there. They were so upset about that. They felt like Auburn had treated them so poorly, so inhospitably. But, they could have left. They could have gone to celebrate in the parking lot, and they wouldn't have had that problem.
Yeah.
And they shouldn't have gone on our field. I mean, you don't ever do that to a visiting team. Yeah. But, we'll talk about 87 in a minute, because this getting the other team's fans wet comes back to us that when we go to Georgia the next year.
Yeah. Well, and Albie got a lot of mileage out of that, too, because I remember the whole next year or two, he would carry a hose with a little spray gun on the end, around his shoulder. Like, look out, I'll zap you. That game was the 16-21. This was Lawyer Tillman's emergence.
Mm-hmm.
This is the game where Lawyer had a huge game at receiver. Berger kept hitting Lawyer, and they couldn't stop him. And Fullwood had a pretty good game. Wasn't it something like the whistle was blown or there was a holding call? There was something. I can't ever get this right. I always forget the exact detail. But Fullwood scored what looked like the winning touchdown, and they called it back for some reason. Like he was stopped, but he wasn't stopped.
Yes,
maybe.
You're right. And there was the whistle blew, and yeah, they said it was down.
Yeah, and so we ended up losing, and that gives us two SEC losses. So we would not win the SEC that year. LSU ends up 5-1. We end up 4-2 in the conference. Now, again, it's worth noting, we did not play LSU in 84 or 86, which were the 2 years that LSU ended up getting to go to the Sugar Bowl and win the SEC ahead of us. Both years, though, when LSU did that, 84 and 86, they played Nebraska and got killed.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of nice. Okay, and so we've run out of time for this week's installment. We will leave the conversation there. John and I will be back on our next episode to pick back up with the end of the 1986 season and carry all the way through to the end of the Pat Dye era, as well as sort of assessing it as a whole, looking back at what it meant for Auburn and for the Auburn family in general and for Auburn football now and into the future. We appreciate you listening. We thank, as always, the WarEagleReader.com, our home on the internet. And we hope that you will look for our new book, Decades of Dominance, Auburn Football in the Modern Era, when it comes out very soon. We're recording this in December of 2012. We expect it to be out sometime in the spring of 2013, and we're really looking forward to it. And otherwise, tune in next time when we move on into the second half of the Die era. This has been the Wishbone Podcast.